This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 21st of April 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly, episode 198, with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
On today's show, we'll be talking climate change with author and researcher at the UCL Energy Institute, Duncan Clark. After all of this chat about how to save the planet, why does he think we've got it all so wrong?
We'll speak to Architecture Foundation director Sarah Ichioka about some of the world's most anticipated culture mega projects. If you build it, will they come?
And back on the eco bender, have you ever been on one of those before, Rob?
Always.
We'll hear about the ecosystems under the sea from filmmaker Michael Piteau.
That is all coming up in the next hour, plus a look ahead to next week's news with Tom Edwards and some music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Brothers in arms, back together again, Andrew.
Reunited, and it feels so good.
Exactly. Through those fields of destruction, baptisms of fire. Let's not do the whole of the Dire Straits song. None of our listeners need to hear us reciting that. Last week, on last week's show, I said, oh, I won't be doing it this week because I'm in LA.
And you're not.
I'm going tomorrow, aren't I? So I lied. Sorry, everyone, I'm still here.
Sophie Grove is there, though.
Sophie Grove's there, yeah. I might cross over with the Grovester in Los Angeles.
You have a day together?
Yeah, probably.
Walking down the beach?
Yeah. Well, you know what she's like. She basically goes swimming. She's famous for going swimming everywhere she ever goes on assignment, whether it's Greenland or LA.
I know. She's not scared by cold water.
She's not. But she might be going like a fish out of water in LA because she might find it surprisingly and slightly irritatingly temperate.
Now, we had the first little bit of sun here in London this week.
Yeah.
And when I came back to the office one day, there was all the shrubbery in our courtyard, and there was two little feet kind of sticking out from the shrubbery. That's all you could see, two little feet.
That's Steve.
And I know. well, not that small. the feet reached the ground. But I just knew that they had to be your feet.
It's a sort of magnet. Sounds like a magnet.
You're literally drawn to the sun the second it comes out.
I've got a bit of colour in the face.
Yes.
That's not just...
I thought that was alcohol. But
it's not just any of last night's exuberance.
Okay.
That's proper... what do you call it? That's photosynthesis happening. That's what's been happening there.
You were on a bit of an eco-bender out there, weren't you?
I was on an eco-bender. I was out in the shrubbery. I was doing some weeding for Sally.
Sally, who's our kind of... I'm not sure what her title is. It's many things, but she kind of...
Bossy boots.
Keeper of the house around here.
Yeah, exactly.
She'll chase you around with a broom if you're not well behaved.
Exactly. I had to make sure I cleaned the aforementioned shoes before I even stepped outside. it's been an all right week though, right?
Yeah, not too bad. And you looked kind of relieved that you'd filed everything for the book as well.
Yeah, I know. You can always tell because I'm like earphones on, completely antisocial, and then as soon as I've done it, hey, let's have fun. Let's not do anything now.
Where are the beers?
It's a bit unsubtle. Yes, exactly. It was a decent one. I started off the week in Paris, which was great. Day trip to Paris to see the Fondation Cartier and the Musée du Quai Branly. A couple of great shows there. That's a nice way to kick off the week. I love Paris in the springtime. And do you want to sing that? Do you want to do the rest of that song as well, like Brothers in Arms?
I can murder any song, so even that. And I came back from a very nice... I went to Madrid for 2 days for the shows last week, and then I stayed on for the weekend as well.
Yeah, good.
And it was summer there.
Should you go on a mini break? I'm going on a mini
eco-bender break is what I
went. What do you think
on.
That is? Like kind of going... what do you think? It's eating kind of loads of lentils and driving to sort of Shropshire or something. Is that an eco-bender? I don't know what that...
In a dish of her,
going and visiting some wind farms.
Yeah. You'd probably be your own movable wind farm if you'd eaten all those lentils.
I knew you were going to say that. Let's put a sound effect in. what better way, therefore,
to introduce
our news editor, the one and only Tom Edwards.
It's Sunday, it's midday, live from London. This is the Monocle Weekly. With his look ahead to the week's events, here's Tom Edwards.
It's literally the happiest point of the week.
It's special, isn't it?
It's something like Pebble Mill at one.
Have you... Have you been on an eco-bender, Tom? What was that noise, Tom? Rob, I think Tom's been on an eco-bender as well.
Yeah, have you been? You've driven to Dundee on a diet of nothing but lentils.
Hey, are you both off your meds?
Get the aircon and let's start the show.
Okay.
Where are you going to start, Tom?
Well, tomorrow, why don't we head to Abu Dhabi?
Yes.
We're going there later in the show.
Well, it's for...
We're going to Saadia Island later in the show.
Oh, well, this is it. The birth of a museum exhibition.
Tell us.
Starts tomorrow. I think we talked about this before on Monocle 24. Obviously, there's this whole cultural region that's being launched. They've got their birth of a museum exhibition. It's the world of Louvre Abu Dhabi opening up. They've got some pretty amazing stuff they're showing. A never-before-seen work by Pablo Picasso, Portrait of a Lady, 1928. If you're asking.
Well, I think it's been seen before.
It's never been displayed before.
Okay.
It's never been seen in public. I mean, somebody has seen it. That is true. I need to be more accurate.
Watch it, Tom, because Andrew's in one of those moods today, I can tell.
Very, studious. Very. The devil in the detail, of course, Andrew. But they've got modest ambitions. They want to match the globe-spanning collections of the great 18th century museums of Europe.
Yeah.
Pictured in at the top. But really interesting. They've got, you know, and there's plenty of modern masters, Gauguin, Manet, Cy Twombly. Like, they're not afraid of engaging with some of the, you know, maybe some of the more challenging names of 20th century and 21st century art. It's all in there.
Well, later on, we've got Sarah Ichioka coming on from the Architectural Foundation here in London, and she's going to talk about these big museums and the role they play. So we're not going to pick your brain on that one. So can we have a bit more then?
Yeah, well, let's talk a bit about geopolitics.
Why not?
A Tuesday and Wednesday, US Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel is visiting Jordan. Now, it's obviously a key ally in the Middle East. And you'll remember, if we think back to the end of last week, news that the US was actually going to deploy some 200 troops to Jordan, sort of, you know, along the Syrian border, which is quite an interesting and important development. And not only will Hagel be involved in briefings with both sides of trying to fix the Syria problem, it's also worth bearing in mind that King Abdullah is heading to the White House soon. It's a kind of a really important measure, a yardstick in the relationship between the US and Jordan, particularly with the Syrian crisis, which is literally on their doorstep.
And of course, this week, President Assad did give this interview where he said the West were going to pay for their backing of rebels in his country. And that's obviously the fear in Jordan, isn't it? That some of this kind of violence could spill over there and topple a regime that's certainly pro-Western.
Absolutely. I mean, it looks more and more like they're going to be a sort of pawn in this game between particularly the US and the Syrians as the sort of main power broker. So I think it's going to be a real test for Chuck Hagel. But look, that's why you get into these kind of jobs, isn't it? For the big challenges. He's certainly got his work cut out.
Go, Chuck.
What about a bit of parliamentary politics from Europe? Like a bit of that? Iceland. They're going to the polls on Saturday. Parliamentary elections. It's quite interesting. There's some new parties on the scene. And there's just an interesting general sort of backdrop within Iceland. There's been an interesting sort of coalition government there. We've had figures like Jóhanna Sigurðardóttir, who's led the coalition. She's the first female Prime Minister of Iceland, the first openly gay head of government anywhere in the world. It's a really interesting character, and I think it'd just be interesting to take a bit of a barometer of where Iceland's at politically. It's obviously had an incredibly turbulent time, particularly since 2008. And just an interesting one to watch for poll watchers.
I read an interesting story about her. She went to China, and she went with her wife, but the Chinese didn't mention that the wife was there because they didn't know how to kind of deal with it.
Well, this was very incendiary, actually, because a lot of gay rights activists in China, talking about difficult jobs, that's one of them, they were very upset about that because all of the sort of usual diplomacy was observed, nothing was mentioned, and they were saying, well, hang on, there's surely some double standards here. Why is it okay for, you know, the government to meet with people that it would profess to, you know, criminalise and stuff at home? So it was a really interesting trip for her to go on, I think.
Go Iceland.
Is it going to be some Iceland stuff on the schedule next week, Tom?
Yeah, you better believe it.
Yeah? Nice.
Thank you, Tom.
That was a news look ahead. Andrew, don't you feel that mixed light and shade, important world events, and a little bit of culture in there too,
like
took
to
us all around the world. I feel like I've dipped
my... culture. That's always just for you, Rob.
Thank you.
It's a gift from me to you.
Tom, thank you.
Thank you, as ever, Tom Edwards. You are tuned in, of course, to the Monocle Weekly, and we'll be meeting author Duncan Clark, who'll take the temperature on all the misguided ways we've been tackling climate change just after this. climate change. The term has become a bit of a cliche, the subject of millions of column inches, scores of international summits, and at least one blockbuster documentary. But with so much attention being paid to the subject and so much action being taken too, is anything actually getting better?
We're joined in studio by Duncan Clark, visiting researcher at the UCL Energy Institute and co-author of The Burning Question, a book that challenges the way we've approached helping keep our environmental challenges in check. Duncan, straight into this. We've, over the last few weeks, had a few people coming in here with various books on the environment. We've had somebody telling us how the sun, harnessing the sun, will solve everything. We've been told that nuclear fuel is the future and that we've just got to kind of forget our prejudices. Do you find it quite a complicated time to come out with a book when so many people, there's so many dissenting voices, that for the public, it becomes almost impossible to tune into any one of those conversations, I think?
I mean, I think that's absolutely right. And actually, what we try and do in this book is say, well, if you really step back and you look at it in a really big picture way, it's actually extraordinarily simple, because you can go down the path of talking about solar or talking about nuclear. Whether you like them or not, those don't in themselves solve the problem. What solves the problem is getting rid of fossil fuels. And what people have misunderstood is that they think that if you build new clean energy sources, then automatically you'll use less fossil fuel. And actually, when you really look at the whole dynamics of global energy use, you realise that whatever energy sources have come on stream, we've tended to use more of the old ones as well. So we had coal first, and then we discovered oil, but oil turned out to be very useful for getting more coal out of the ground. And so there's no reason now to believe that if you look at it in a kind of global system level, that if you add more nuclear or solar or anything else, there's no real reason to believe that that means we'll burn any less oil, coal or gas.
So you're kind of, I mean, the book isn't necessarily a campaigning book. It is more of a stepping back, as you say, and looking at the larger picture. But I guess the key thing of leave it in the ground.
Exactly. So that was a long spiel to get to a very simple point, which is if you want to solve
climate change,
leave it in the ground. It's exactly the right point.
Well, I've always had this feeling that I feel that, rightly or wrongly, burning fossil fuels is sort of a human instinct. Do you know what I mean? Because it's burning wood to keep warm. I mean, it's a pretty primal thing. Do we have to sort of unteach ourselves our instinct in a way? Do you think?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting point, because actually if you really think of energy use right back to the very beginning, the thing that really made us humans is how clever we are. And the reason our brains are so big is because we discovered fire, and it was fire that unlocked better diets, and it was better diets that allowed us to consume enough energy to grow the brains we needed to invent agriculture and so on and so on. So I think you're right that there is a kind of very fundamental human instinct in taking a useful substance and setting fire to it to create heat, to create power, to create light, whatever else it is. The reality, though, is that we have all sorts of other ways of doing those things. What we need to do is start phasing out the fossil fuel and then let the other ones scale up.
But do you think that the whole premise of your book is based on the kind of an idea almost of us changing how we live? And that's the challenge, isn't it? Because, you know, it's great if we know what the problem is, but you look at how complicated it is to nudge an economy, you know, in any direction. You know, we have, you know, supposedly the best minds in the world, you know, sitting in ministries all across the world. They can't do anything about the economy, it seems. You know, their grasp of it is very limited. Industrialists will kind of do what they think will make the quickest amount of money. They're not really invested in kind of the long term. How can you change all of that kind of aspiration, even if people do know there's a huge problem?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, there's no doubt. I mean, one can sum up that climate change is a simple problem. You just need to get off fossil fuels. Of course, getting off fossil fuels is not a simple task. It's probably the most difficult and important task that humankind has ever faced. But I think it all comes back to understanding the problem properly. You said earlier, is this about changing the way we live? And that's a good example of how actually it's possible to just overcomplicate things. So a lot of Greens say if we lived differently, then fossil fuel use would fall and emissions would come down. And what we argue in the book is actually if we live differently, then that doesn't stop BP taking its oil out of the ground. If we use less gas, it doesn't mean that Gazprom will suddenly leave its gas in the ground. It suddenly means that gas prices will fall and fertilizer use will go up. And one way or another, if the fuel's coming out of the ground, it will get used. So rather than saying we need to change how we live and we hope that somehow indirectly affects fossil fuel use, what we need to do is say, well, let's live however we want, but let's do it whilst cutting fossil fuel use.
So you're literally saying there would be a cap on the amount of fossil fuel you were allowed to take out of the ground?
Yeah, there's lots of different ways you can do it. You've basically got to cap the total amount of carbon we put into the atmosphere. And that has very obvious implications for the fossil fuel sector. It means that most of the reserves which are currently on the books would have to stay untapped in the ground until we've got some kind of technology for burning them and capturing the carbon, which is completely plausible. But again, it's something that won't happen by itself. It's only when you say you can't burn the fuel in the normal way that people have an incentive to scale up the technology that allows them to burn it safely.
And you expect, so it sounds like you're expecting, Duncan, for this to be a sort of international, at least a national governmental decision that has to be made. There has to be a structure and process. This isn't about recycling stuff. This isn't about a personal, you know, one household at a time, one person at a time. This is national stuff.
That's right. And actually, it's very much international stuff. And one of the analogies we use in the book is to think of global energy use as being like trying to squeeze a balloon. So you make a saving in one place and a bulge just pops up somewhere else. But basically, it's true that if one country uses less fuel, then it's almost certain that a lot of the benefits will be cancelled out by more fuel being used elsewhere. I mean, it's just common sense. But what's less common sense and equally important is that if that fuel gets freed up and it stimulates economic activity in another country, well, that's great if you want to grow the economy. But it also might have a whole set of ripple effects that end up with even more fossil fuel being used. So you've got to look at it at an international level. And then the question for what a family can do, what a national government can do, it has to be about what can that agent do to try and affect global change. And so in a way, you know, if we all try and live a bit greener, that is an important part of it because, you know, unless we try and do something, then what moral authority do we possibly have to say to the rest of the world, well, you shouldn't be using fossil fuel when we're using as much as possible. So there's certainly an argument for local action and for personal action. But if you think that by turning the lights off, that less carbon's going to go into the air, then you're definitely oversimplifying things and you're probably not doing as much good as you think.
Because we're all at the end of that chain, everything we touch, you know, whether it's the food we eat has been moved on ships, you know, powered by oil. You know, the very book that you've published about this problem is, you know, made by a printing press, run on electricity, probably powered by oil, probably the whole mechanism for sending your book around the world is completely dependent on fossil fuels and its use. So
absolutely. You know, I mean, one of the things we say in the book...
I actually almost got hit by the pigeon that delivered this book. Right? And I'd like to applaud you for that low-carbon way of delivering the book.
Yeah, maybe that's the answer.
No, but it's impossible to kind of for the individual to disconnect unless they want to go and live in a kind of yurt.
Completely.
Which I don't particularly want to do. You can't help but use fossil fuels. You know, even if you are kind of like, you know, recycling your fairy washing liquid bottle, or whatever.
Totally. And the whole debate has become very much sort of grounded on kind of guilt and the idea that actually most of the oil is being used by people with huge SUVs and patio heaters and who are flying around the world every day. And it's true that there are some people with very high carbon footprints. But actually, if you really look at where the fossil fuel goes, it goes everywhere. You know, it goes into the factory that produced the mixing desk that we're using to record this radio show. It went into the power station that's funding, it's the internet, it's hospitals, it's schools, it's absolutely everything. So to try and sort of individually separate yourself off from that is really creating a rod for your own back and also not necessarily being as helpful as you think.
But at the top end of that scale, you know, I often hear this debate, you know, that from environmentalists that we have to give up on the idea of growth, that, you know, we have to come to a model, you know, maybe a little bit like Bhutan or something where we're happier with being happy and we don't want to make so many things and we live with less. And again, that seems to be fine if you're sitting in Europe and you've got to the end of a piece of history where you can be a bit jaded about having lots of things. But if you're sitting in Guangzhou, that's not a conversation that you'll find going on around the dinner table.
Totally. I mean, that's one important point about the growth debate is that it's obviously a very different debate in rich countries and poor countries. And actually, a lot of people who just call for ending economic growth say that you should do it only in the rich countries because that's more humane. But of course, if you only do it in the rich countries, then the fuel will just get burned elsewhere. So you might have helped with global inequality, but you probably won't have helped with climate change. So actually, I think in a way, the broader context here is that that's another example of how it's possible to overcomplicate things. Because in the same way that you might turn off the lights and somehow hope that means that Gazprom takes less gas out of the ground, if you say, well, we're going to end economic growth and somehow help, you're still making the same very optimistic assumption, which is that will somehow lead to less fuel being burned. And it's not at all obvious that that's actually true. I mean, if you slow down economic growth, you might slow down technological change, which might mean that we cease to be developing the low carbon alternatives that could eventually replace fossil fuels. So again, you have to have it the right way around. You have to say, let's get rid of the fossil fuels because that's what we do to solve climate change. And then the conversation is, will that lead to a world in which economic growth is still possible? And that's a really important and a really interesting debate. And what we argue in the book is that actually anyone who thinks that they have the answer to that and says confidently that either the economy would shrink or would grow is just making it up, really, because the unknowns are so vast. I mean, the world has never tried to phase out fossil fuel before. And if and when we start doing it, we'll have to wait and see what happens.
And that's just, I just wanted to finish almost where we started with that idea of instinct, Duncan. It's a weird thing. You said the world's never tried to do this before, because the world's never tried to do anything before. The world's always just followed its instinct, right? And that's the problem with this, isn't it? This is, it properly is a huge intellect. We have to actually make an intellectual decision, don't we?
That's exactly right. And I mean, there have been cases where the world has, you know, universally agreed to do something. And you know, a good example, which often comes up in the climate discussion, is the ozone hole, where, you know, against huge amounts of lobbying from chemical companies, the world decided collectively, well, let's start phasing out these chemicals and let's introduce trade treaties that mean if you produce them, then we're not going to import them. And let's just, you know, be a little bit hard ass about the whole thing and just get rid of them. And it worked well. The difference here is that those fossil fuels we need to leave in the ground, they're not just worth billions or hundreds of billions. They're worth tens of trillions of dollars. I mean, they're some of the most valuable assets on the planet. And they're bound up with political power. I mean, if you're the ruling family of Saudi Arabia, then what happens in the international oil markets isn't a kind of detail for you. It's a matter of whether or not you're going to get overthrown.
Yeah.
So there are, you know, it's bound up with huge amounts of power, huge amounts of lobbying, and a huge amount of cultural inertia. And the question is, can we not just agree to solve the problem? Because actually all nations in the world have already said, let's limit temperature rise to 2 degrees. The question is, can we get beyond that and say, let's actually do it?
Well, Duncan, thank you so much for coming in. Duncan Clark, co-author of The Burning Question with Mike Berners-Lee. Thanks for coming in and joining us on The Weekly.
My pleasure.
We love to champion retailers who make a point of differentiating themselves from other offerings on the high street. Our latest Monocle briefing film travels to Buenos Aires, New York and Budapest to visit specialist shops where making is at the heart of their retail offering.
One of the big challenges with any denim brand, or any brand for that matter, is to really try and explain to the customer why it's special, why it's unique, and why it's worth investing, you know, a lot of money in a great product.
You can view Handmade Retailers and over 300 more films and slideshows on monocle.com.
We're off to Hong Kong, Abu Dhabi and St. Petersburg to discuss museums next. But first, something new from Daft Punk. This is Get Lucky.
Like the legend of the Phoenix, huh, all ends with beginnings.
That was Get Lucky, new from Daft Punk. And you're tuned in to The Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck. What do Hong Kong, Abu Dhabi and St. Petersburg have in common? In each of these cities, massive cultural projects are underway. They're some of the world's most anticipated urban developments, designed by some of the world's most prominent architects. But what is their worth? Will they attract gallery goers to visit their cities? Are they building a new set of domestic culture vultures, or are they just a good tool for city branding?
The Architecture Foundation, based here in London, has been asking that very question in a series of talks by the name of If You Build It, Will They Come? The most recent instalment happened this week at Tate Modern and featured some of the master planners, architects and curators of Hong Kong's West Kowloon Cultural District, St. Petersburg, New Holland Island and the Louvre, Abu Dhabi. Sarah Ichioka is director of the Architecture Foundation and joins us in the studio now. Sarah, could you just explain to us, first of all, what is it about these three projects do you think that kind of links them, that's so special about them?
I suppose in all three of these contexts, there's not such a strong native contemporary cultural scene, although there are three very, very different urban contexts, and they all share that in common. And so in a way, these museum projects that are going in are not only needing to create new buildings for cultural scenes, new contemporary cultural consumers.
Because I guess, we think when we think of somewhere, like St. Petersburg, obviously it has an incredible cultural history and, an amazing museums. But is it the fact that there's not a contemporary version of that existing in the city?
Absolutely. I think if you look at culture in Russia at the moment, Moscow very much dominates in terms of the contemporary. Obviously, St. Petersburg has tremendous, 300 years of amazing history of architecture and art there. But what the Iris Foundation, who are developing this new cultural center at New Holland Island in the middle of St. Petersburg, are trying to do is really bridge the divide from the historic through to the contemporary.
And also, these are actually physically new places. I mean, Sadia Island's kind of being built out of the water, as is New Holland. I mean, as was St. Petersburg itself, obviously. But this isn't just like a new museum. This isn't just a new kind of cultural district. They're building islands to put these things on, right?
Well, Sadia Island in particular is at the moment pretty much a barren beachfront with some foundations coming out of it for this, what will be a raft of kind of jewel-like buildings by a collection of Pritzker Prize winners. New Holland Island is slightly different in that it
sort of was there.
It was there, but it's been closed to the public for 300 years. It was originally set up by Peter the Great.
That was before there even was a public, right, in Russia.
Negligible. I mean, it was essentially a military and scientific base. So in a way, the buildings are 300 years old, but it's only in the last couple of years the public have been able to access them. And then West Kowloon, you're right, it's attached to the rest of Hong Kong, but it is a new strip of land that's become available with the connection of a new high-speed rail link to mainland China that's kind of activated this development.
Do you think these cities, they're all trying to reinvent themselves in some way with culture? Obviously, clearly in the case of Abu Dhabi, the much worn out example always, I guess, is Bilbao, where we saw the impact of one cultural institution and one slightly showy building on a small city that had terrible problems of a dwindling economy and an old school economy at that. For all of these places, are they trying to rebrand themselves, sell themselves to the world in a different way with these projects, do you think?
I would say particularly the Sadiat Island project, where the Louvre Abu Dhabi will be housed, fits that model very much. There's a very concerted top-down effort. The government of Abu Dhabi have formed an international partnership with the government of France. The whole the development's been informed by the French Museums Authority. There are very formal exchange mechanisms that are being set up. In the case of New Holland Island, I think it's happening a bit more organically. It's actually all being done through private money, in a way, is kind of running up against the encounter with a very active local population of consumers. In West Kowloon, it's really interesting. Actually, it was so fascinating to hear the speakers talk on Monday, because it was originally seen in a kind of more generically attempt to attract tourism. But the local creative community over the last 10 years that the project's been developing have been really, really keen to make it a properly organic of the place, of Hong Kong, for the people who live there. So it's undergone a really tremendous transformation of its mission through that process.
And Hong Kong needs that as well. I think the West Kowloon Cultural District, I'm excited about that personally out of these three things, because I really think that Hong Kong needs it. Hong Kong's a lot of money. It doesn't have enough of this kind of stuff going on. So even if you build it, I think this is the one where you build it and they will come, kind of thing, actually.
I think that's right. I think particularly for Hong Kong at this moment in its kind of cultural economic development and the massive, unignorable rise of mainland China, the fact that exhibitions, in the 90s would come first to Hong Kong and then maybe to mainland. Yeah. Now, if they're touring, they'll go to Beijing, they'll go to Shanghai, all the artists are in Beijing. It really does need something to reposition itself in relation to the mainland.
I wanted to ask you, you as director of the Architecture Foundation as well, it's interesting that we're approaching this discussion from the point of view of the buildings that these paintings, not just paintings, but these cultural initiatives are going to sit in, right? I mean, that's always the thing. Where's the rub lie in the building, in the Jean Nouvel, building in Abu Dhabi, or in the paintings that are on loan from the Louvre,
Well, what's really interesting about the Louvre Abu Dhabi one is as was revealed by the project leader, Hala Warda, at our event, they were briefed to build this building before they knew what would go in it.
Right.
So in a that's way, just that's be, the
it's
ultimate
be a factory for Hoovers.
They knew it. Well, fair enough. They knew it was going to be a museum, but they didn't know what the content would be. So in that instance, it's absolutely architecture, starchitecture, instrumentalized as a tool of image creation, really, and kind of place branding. In other places, I think it's, you're right, it's a much more subtle play between what the content will be and what the buildings that will house it will be. And they have different weights, I suppose.
Can I ask you, I wonder, what do you think is different about these projects and kind of what's always happened in a way? I wonder when they built, you know, a cultural district, you know, in the west of London that was, you know, the Victoria and Albert Museum and all the science museums that flowed around then. Or even, you know, 10, 15 years ago when we saw the opening of Tate Modern and that kind of rewired a part of southern London, you know, that made the focus of the city shift a little bit. Or are they not different? Are these all part of a kind of a heritage of how we use these organisations and these institutions just getting bigger and bigger as they roll on?
I think you've put your finger on it. I mean, I think they're part of a continuum that you can see. I mean, the fact that the Victoria and Albert was very much established as a place that was meant to improve the quality of British industry. I mean, culture has always been instrumentalized, hasn't it? And there's a strong tradition of, you know, the robber baron showing off his taste. So I very much think there's a continuum. And I think one of the most interesting things to look at now is how there's a this almost franchise model of these European or North American brand name cultural venues that are then forging these links around the world, you know, the Louvre, Abu Dhabi. There was originally an idea that West Kowloon might host a branch of Centre Pompidou or a branch of the Guggenheim. Of course, that was resisted. Now it's going to be very much an organically grown of Hong Kong series of institutions there. But I think it's very much on a continuum, and the projects are very much globally linked to their predecessors elsewhere.
Finally, it would be nice to tackle this question, Sarah, of the urban change thing. Mm. Have you looked back and sort of seen visitor numbers, seen footfall, kind of seen the positive effects that these buildings have? I mean, is it a myth? Or I mean, we kind of think, as Andrew said, we talk about the Guggenheim effect in Bilbao and all the rest of it. Everyone's obviously kind of trying to drive in that slipstream. Does it really work?
What's really interesting about the Guggenheim model, and I think if you talk to representatives from the Basque government who were active in the 80s and 90s, it drives them a bit mad, is so the Guggenheim opened in 1997, and there'd actually been plans underway for the whole previous decade for a series of really strategic infrastructural investments, like a new subway system, a new airport, and in a way the museum is the most visible manifestation of that, and clearly kind of the jewel in the crown, but actually I don't believe that it would have been as successful, you know, attracting 1 million visitors a year plus, if it had not been for it being part of this larger social and economic investment that the government very strategically undertook. I think, you know, maybe looking a little bit closer home, we're having this conversation in London, you can look at the Turner Contemporary in Margate. It just celebrated its second anniversary this week, didn't it? And they've, on the one hand, been very successful. I think they've cited like 500,000 visitors in their
and
first
it's a really
year.
It's a great building. My favourite thing was going to the opening of that and was personally shown the best fish and chip shop in Margate by Tracy Emin.
Well, I mean, it's, you know, it's really lucky that it not only has this cultural gallery, but it has some great, you know, native sons and daughters who are, you know, really passionate about it. But, you know, you look at that, lots of visitors, but still it has 30% vacancy in all of its retail units across Margate. So, you know, there's still a lot of work to be done, and one can't expect one jewel-like building by David Chipperfield to, you know, be a panacea. So these things need to be looked at in their larger strategic investment context.
And where does the Architecture Foundation's involvement with this go? Is it, do you keep an eye on these kind of things? How does it work with you guys? Where does it go for you from now on?
We're really interested in keeping the conversation going. I think there are a whole range of other types of initiatives one could look at. For example, the proliferation of festivals and biennales that's taking place around the world. We're really interested to explore that. Also perhaps interested in looking at more organically grown cultural districts based more around studio space and residential areas for artists, curators, etc. So yeah, it's really about trying to raise a friendly but critical voice about these projects at key stages so that it possibly influences future developments of their nature.
Can I ask you one quick question?
Of course you can.
As well, is I love temporary buildings. Mm. I love temporary theatres. There's this the shed down on the South Bank. It's going to be there for a year. I love stuff like that. That really makes, that gives a real energy. Mm-mm. And if you knock it down after a year and rebuild something that's a different shape, that's cool. Mm. Is that an important, do you guys look at stuff like that?
Yeah, absolutely. And if we had more time, I'd love to tell you about all the projects we've been involved in. But just maybe one thing quickly, a nice way to end things off is to talk about New Holland Island. So they're not going to have shovels in the ground until next year. But in the time that they've had access to the island, they've brought in a series of temporary interventions that kind of in a way replicate what will be there in terms of different uses. So cultural activities, food, startup office space, etc., all housed in shipping containers or temporary structures. So they're kind of getting the best of both worlds with the temporary helping to build an audience and an energy through to what will hopefully be delivered in permanent form.
That's fascinating stuff. I want to draw a skyline now. I want to draw my fantasy skyline. Sarah Gioca, Director of the Architecture Foundation, thank you so much for joining us on the weekly.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Sarah Gioca, thank you very much.
We'll be back in a moment and head down under the sea with filmmaker Michael Pitio.
If you've ever wondered how the shirt on your back came into being, or the roof over your head, the chair you sit on, the laptop you tap on, the office you work in, the train, plane, car, boat, bicycle and lift that transport you, the phone you talk on, or even the bath that you soak in. If you want to know about the things that you live with, then tune into Section D, Monocle 24's weekly dip into the world of design. Premiering each Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, we hop from front row to back street, workshop to fairground, taking in the latest in the worlds of architecture, fashion, retail, transport, technology and graphics. If you want to know how design impacts your daily life and who the people are dedicated to making life better, then pull up a pew and tune in.
Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Planet Ocean is a 90-minute documentary directed by world-renowned filmmakers Jan Arthurs Bertrand and Michael Pitio.
The film aims to raise awareness of the importance of the ocean to the ecosystem and boasts a combination of stunning aerial filming and underwater photography. Monocle's Phil Hahn sat down with Michael Pitio, whose previous projects have taken him to Vietnam, the former Soviet Union, and Afghanistan. He explained the aims of the project.
So, Michael, thanks very much for coming in today. Tell me a bit about this film.
It's a film about humankind. We choose to use the ocean as a sort of paradigm of our planet and the place that we're living in and the way we are living in and how we're connected to a long, long natural history. At the beginning, it was a film about, you know, the ocean, the beautiful ocean, like Jan loved to do such things. I mean, he loved, you know, the great shots and the great landscapes. And, well, and he came to me and said, well, I want to make a great film on the ocean. And we were talking about the script and the idea of the film, and day after day came the idea that we had to talk about humankind first because we are connected to this history. And that was the beginning of Planet Ocean.
You know, there are so many documentaries out there about the ocean, about wildlife, about the relationship that humans have with Mother Earth. What makes this particular documentary, in your opinion, different?
Well, the challenge was to bring the audience inside the story. To say, well, look, wildlife is fantastic. We have to protect that. Or, look, we humans are very bad people and, you know, we're making bad things. And, well, no, the challenge was to just tell a simple story. And this story is we humans want to live on this planet. So what shall we do? And what are we facing? And that's all. And I think that's the difference in this film.
And you partnered with Jan Arthurs Bertrand, one of the most well-known photographers. You know, tell me about the way this film was shot and how different of a way it was put together.
Well, this film is made part of aerial views and part of underwater shots. For the helicopter shot, we managed that with Jan in, I would say, the standard way. Well, we're making this with Cineflex cameras with very high stabilization system. Well, I would say that's the basics of Jan's job. For the underwater shots, we had another approach, a very creative and different approach. We choose to ask specialized cameramen from all over the world to work with us. And we had a special contract with them. They had to film for us some specific sequences, and they also had to bring with them some shots and special shots they had in the year. That was very interesting because sometimes it can take years just to have the right shot of the whales, of the plankton or coral sea or whatever. And, well, we cannot afford this time to make this film. So we were very interested in sharing this knowledge. That was a success. I mean, we had 12 crew from all over the world, from America, from South Africa, from Chile, from UK, from France, of course, from Australia. You know, they were skilled people with tremendous footage that they shot in the last couple of years, and they were just showing that to us and just say, wow, look, this is amazing. And we had this, you know, first choice each time, and we came from surprise to surprise. Even Jan said to me, wow, they're better than I in shooting. So, you know, that was a great success for that. And they were all very happy to share this film. And that was the other great news of this approach. Most of them say to us, well, Planet Ocean is our film now, so we want to be part of this, and we're going to give you some of those shots.
The aerial shots that we see are absolutely stunning, but they really are such a small portion of life in the ocean. So how important was it to really get beneath the waves, so to speak, and show what life is like beneath the surface?
Well, that was the main challenge of this film, and in a way, of any film on the ocean. You know, all life is under the surface. So, and that's a sort of parable, like, for the story of the film. I mean, we cannot see anything, you know. When you are looking at the ocean, you can say, wow, it's nice, and there is nice waves and whatever, but you cannot see the life behind the surface. And it's exactly what is happening to humankind today. We cannot even imagine what is going to happen to us. So, you know, that was interesting to have this parable.
So tell me some of the scenes that you saw that really, disturbed you and your crew. Because obviously in the oceans there are problems like, obviously, garbage, overfishing, pollution, coral bleaching. What were the moments that really stuck out for you that showed the destruction that humans were causing?
Well, there is different. I think the first one, of course, is overfishing. It's a question of, maybe not overfishing, but the question of quotas and the bycatch. Because, you know, that's terrible to see those fishing vessels throwing away tons of fish just because they don't get the permit to fish that. And that's, well, that's life we are throwing away. And those fishes are dead, and they are dead for, well, for nothing, just for a question of paper. So I think it was very hard to film that, and we're very sad with that. The other big issue and very surprising fact is the plastic gyre in the Pacific Ocean, close to the Midway Islands. When you see those birds full of plastic pieces, you know, and we are thousands of kilometers from home, from any place where the humans are living, and you see that there is so many pollution, even here. Well, you understand that it's too late. We have been too far. You can feel sad at this time.
And obviously one of the big points of this film is to try to show humans the impact and the relationship that we have with the oceans. Do you think that when people watch this, it might change their mindset to go, hey, I actually, you know, I need to change the way I live my life, and I need to try to educate people because, you know, we only really have one ocean?
Well, I think that's the main objective of this film. And, you know, the objective is not to save the ocean. The objective is to save humankind. I think we have to take our destiny on hand now. And we don't have any solution left. I mean, you know, the more we go, the more educated we are, the more powerful we are, the more dangerous the place we are living in is becoming, just because we are living on a small planet and we have more and more needs. And, well, that's sort of a simple equation. We cannot go this way, so we have to change the way we are living.
But you don't necessarily think that we will change, do you?
I think, well, the question, the answer belongs to the audience. And, you know, we had a lot of screening in France, in America, in Rio for the first, for the premiere. And usually the audience is shocked at the end of the film. We had some standing ovation, we have some... And each time we have people coming at the end of the screening just saying, what can I do now? Because I don't want this. I don't want to live in the world you are showing me. And yeah, maybe in a way we can keep optimistic.
But you screened this film at Rio Plus 20 last year. You said it got rave reviews, but you said the conference came away with nothing.
Yeah, and even worse, I mean, the conference turned to be a fiasco because we go reverse on some major decision concerning our planet and the way to preserve the planet and so on. So why? Because there's only economical aspect of the answer. But, you know, what is...
How disappointing is that then for you to see leaders do
that?
It's
very disappointing because the question is not, you know, people, it's not the audience reaction. The question is how politically we can handle this situation. And and today we cannot. We don't know how to do it. It's very hard for political people just to say, okay, now we have to change the way we are living, or we have to stop fishing this, or we have to stop polluting like this. It's impossible. You know, we are not in this world. I mean, we are organized with lobbies, we are organized with economical interest. And even if the people is willing to do so, it's so inertial, it's so hard to change the course. And I think that is the most disappointing fact for us.
And getting back to the film, visually, Planet Ocean is absolutely stunning. It's one of the most amazing films I think I've seen. But also, the written aspect of it is spectacular. Tell us about the script and how important that was for the film.
Well, the script was... basically, the challenge was to get the audience with us in this film and to say it's not a story of the planet, it's not the story of the ocean, it's not the story of, you know, human people living on the planet. No, it's our story. So that was the challenge of the script and the way to tell the story, to say we human are living on such a planet and this is our way of life and this is my story I'm telling me. And in a way, we think that maybe we are like this, we human are like this. Maybe we have to stop thinking that our leaders will take, you know, the good decision each time. We have to make a choice ourselves. And maybe with the full group of human, we can change the course together.
And that was filmmaker Michael Pitiot speaking to Monocle's Phil Hahn. And that's it, Andrew. 198 down.
What are we going to do in 2 weeks' time?
I don't know. What? Let's have some bunting, some cakes.
I love bunting. Do you have to make your own bunting still?
I'm using it as a euphemism, something else.
Okay.
Yeah, we should. I mean, 200. That's a lot of these things, right? That's a double century.
Yeah, I think we need to mark it in a nice important way.
We should certainly have. We should maybe have this. Maybe we should have our features meeting off there. We should get some of our favourite guests.
And then, don't forget.
And then we won't have to come back after lunch.
Good.
That's that sorted. Yeah, no, we should be proud of that. 200 up. We should talk about this on the 200th edition. But we should get the old gang back together.
Yes.
That's Tyler, but he's probably somewhere. I don't know how.
No, I think actually he might actually be here in 2 weeks' time.
Let's get him in headlock. Let's book get him in here. Get him in here. And we'll be like old days.
I'm looking forward
when
to
it. Was a, when it was essentially, let's face it, sort of wine-fueled extravaganza, wasn't it? It was, wasn't it? When we used to do it at the old, before we opened our own studios
before
here.
We had our own studios, and you could occasionally have a nice chocolate biscuit while you were waiting. the biscuit jar.
Yeah, exactly. Sort of slightly, yeah, I like them.
Okay, to them. We're planned. We're all sorted.
That's okay. What I want. I want a Maryland chocolate chip cookie, and a sort of Pinot Grigio. That's fine by me, Andrew. I don't need any Remy Martin.
I seem to remember that was the diet 2 years ago.
It was. Yeah.
Anyway, I think we're done, Rob.
We are done. Today's show was produced by David Michon and Tom Hall. Our researcher was Josh Fennett, and our studio manager was Jack Phillips. We'll be here at the same time next week, probably, won't we?
I will be.
But until then, it's goodbye from me, Robert Bounds.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.